You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Hey, listeners, and welcome back to National Security Law Today. Last week, we spoke with Barbara McQuaid, professor at the University of Michigan Law School, former U.S. attorney, and author of Attack from Within, about how disinformation, polarization, and weakened civic infrastructure are eroding public trust. This week, in part two, we pick back up with the role of social media platforms in the First Amendment. Alisa and Barbara dive into whether platforms should be held accountable for curbing misinformation, and how that question has become a larger debate over free speech and democratic stability. As always, thanks for tuning in, and here's Alisa.
Getting back to this, the First Amendment, I mean, one of the things that gets everybody's hackles up is the idea of interference with free speech. And this is a left and right concern, as well as a center concern.
Absolutely.
Can you talk a little bit about how would we accomplish this without concern that the government would then begin to impede flow of information?
Yes. So on the one hand, they say we are not publishers subject to defamation lawsuits. We're just platforms. Think of us as the soapbox that somebody might stand on in the town square and start giving a speech. We don't have anything to do with whatever it is he's talking about. We just place the soapbox there. That's what a social media platform is. We are giving you the mechanism. Whatever you say, we have no control over that whatsoever. We're just letting people say whatever. We don't control it. We don't monitor it. We don't do anything. On the other hand, they say that they should get the same protections as newspapers in deciding what they can and cannot put up on platforms, that they can deplatform people because they should be entitled to the same editorial discretion as newspapers. Well, which is it? Are you a publisher or are you not a publisher? So I think they have to land on which of those two things they are. But I would say that I would agree that we should not have the government being in the business of telling social media outlets what they can and cannot publish. But what I think they can tell them is that they need to abide by certain regulations when it comes to their own conduct. So it's processes over substance. Instead of telling them you have to do this, what you could instead tell them is maybe you must have a community notes-based fact-checking system, right? That's not telling them what they can and can't say, just that you must create some sort of fact-checking system where people can put up notes and say, actually, the polls are not closed on Tuesday in the state of Michigan on Election Day. Here's a link to the Secretary of State's office. They will be open. Just telling them they have to develop some fact-checking system would be one. The other are the things I just discussed. Your algorithms will be subject to regulation to make sure there is nothing there that is improperly set to generate outrage. Or we don't want you to sell people's private data without their consent and without their notice and to whom. I think those are the things that we can regulate. I would leave content to the marketplace of ideas.
And that's a pretty progressive view right now, because I think people have landed on, you know, you shouldn't be able to say anything that is false. And what is provably false may be one thing, but there is also that gray area where people disagree on facts that I think is healthy.
And I think there's two different things between verifiable facts and things that are mixed fact and opinion. If someone were to say that Joe Smith, whose date of birth is this from, you know, Youngstown, Ohio, said these awful things, Joe Smith's relatives say Joe Smith has been dead for 3 years. He didn't say those things. If they could demonstrate to the social media platform verifiably that that Joe Smith is dead, here is his death certificate, please take that down. Maybe we can require that. If there is a verifiably false claim that is on social media, maybe there can be a process for people to request removal of that false claim. That I think is fine. The problem is, of course, that so much of what is put online is a mix of fact and opinion or interpretation. And that I think just has to be left to the marketplace of ideas to decide whether it's valid or not valid. And we can do that. But I think by having these healthy processes in place, we can reduce the amount of disinformation that is there, the amount of outrage, the amount of sowing of discord that is so often at the heart of these political agendas.
You know, I wondered as I was listening to some of the hearings at Facebook and also sort of watching recent business trends, if eventually some of these founders of these big companies wouldn't ultimately just abandon the platforms altogether as the ideal business model because they are moving into other things now, such as AI, cloud, and there may be another way for them to satisfy their shareholders and their boards and demonstrate return on investment as they're obligated to do in our capitalist system. So I don't know, but you also mentioned something I think does fuel the return on investment, and that is bots and nets. And why don't you talk a little bit about those and what, because they really are a problem and I think they're misunderstood and they're awful tricky to identify if you're busy with your life, or maybe it sounds like something that you think and so you credit it.
Yeah. So one of the things that is rampant on social media, and I think, again, something we could require social media platforms to scrub as a function of their own processes, are these bots, which are AI programmed accounts designed to look like real people, but are in fact simply computer software. And some of the things that they are used for is to get into arguments with people. I've experienced this where I have posted something that maybe is, you know, critical of a particular politician or something. And I will get, you know, 12 identical responses calling me the same name from somebody with, you know, a made up name that's just a number. Their handle on social media is 657321. And it's not, and there's a picture of somebody there. But you realize after getting 12 of these identical messages that this is just somebody's computer program that is designed to look for keywords and will call you certain names if you post about these subjects. So that's one of the ways that bots get used. And so it floods the zone and it causes people to pile on and sows discord online and does things to affect the algorithm about your message. The other thing they use them for is to amplify false claims. So if I'm a Russian operative and I post something online that says, you know, something disparaging about a particular group in American society, I can then get 1,000 bots to like and share that comment. So now my statement, my message, my post looks far more popular than it really was. You know, I'm just one guy who wrote this awful thing, but by getting all this amplification, it causes it to rise in the algorithm for other people and more people are going to see it. So it creates this false impression that a message is more popular than it really is. I think that we could require social media companies to periodically scrub their platforms for these bots, which are quite obvious when you look at them. They have 0 to 1 followers, and they generate 200 messages an hour. There are certain controls on social media platforms to prevent people from automating and sending out too many things. So they'll be calibrated to like one below that number. So if the number's 200, then they'll set it at 199. They can find these, they could scrub these. And I think that is one of the things that contributes to the disinformation online.
Now, my understanding from talking to people who have looked at this more closely than I have is that if they do that, that they would then have a reduced set of eyes by up to 25 to 26%. Some figures are higher, and that if they do that, then they look less successful and they look less profitable to potential advertisers.
Interesting.
So, you know, I'm curious if there isn't a little bit of sort of willful blindness going on here. And, you know, maybe somebody from the platform could disabuse me of that notion. But I know that that is a very strongly held belief among a number of researchers. I think that your idea about bots is actually really good. It's one of the things that I landed on in your book the first time I looked at it and thought this would be a simple fix and would certainly help moderate. The other thing I wondered is if the platforms could also pump other messages in. And by that, I mean like PSAs that we have on television, public service announcements that the platform should be required to disseminate to everybody within, let's say, the United States. I don't think we could force it on other countries, but they could easily do that. They certainly know the IP addresses of the users as well as potentially their MAC addresses. And they know a lot of other things too, because we give it over to them. So I wonder if that couldn't happen. And one other thing that we emphasize at Skolins is the value of civic learning and civic education. And I don't just mean civic institutions, but actually understand the Constitution, how your government works. And I wonder if the platforms, kind of in their own self-interest, couldn't also find themselves obligated to pump out civic education, just like you would if you had linear television and it would be on at midnight. But my point is, I don't feel that they're held to the same obligations as the things that are no longer used as communications media.
Yeah, well, and you're right. And the reason for some of those requirements were they were conditions that the government attached to the privilege of having a broadcast license. So the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, which is the regulator for broadcast media, television and radio, said, we are giving you one of our scarce resources. There are only a certain number of broadcast frequencies that exist in the world. And if we're going to give you one of these licenses to occupy a space on this bandwidth, in exchange, you have to agree to certain conditions. And one of those conditions is the equal time rule and the fairness doctrine and these public service announcements. So even though they're not subject to the FCC, we could make them subject to the FCC. It doesn't have to be tied to a broadcast license. We can say that if you want to operate and enjoy your immunity from legal liability, one of the conditions is that you will remove the bots, and another is that you will run public service announcements. I think we could do that in the best interests of the public. But we've seen such a reluctance by Congress to get involved here. I don't think the courts are going to save us on this one. You know, the courts have said, I think quite appropriately, that one, you don't want to leave to nine people in black dresses how to figure out the internet. Like, I can barely work my cell phone. You don't want us doing this. What you do want is Congress to bring in experts to provide testimony to help recommend legislation for how this can work in the best interests of the public. And certainly, there's plenty of room for profits for people if we maintain this immunity from legal liability, but with certain conditions tied to that benefit, like the ones we're discussing here.
Yeah, and I don't know if it would require the FCC to regulate them, but I think that some contributing to the good in some way. Now, we saw a little bit of this in COVID during the pandemic, where they did pump out health information, locations of where you could get vaccines, and then it ground to a halt and it got sort of labeled ugly. The other thing is, I think we have to be realistic too about elections, how much they cost and how much these internet companies contribute to candidates and what their lobbying effort is in Washington. These big internet companies, and I'm talking about big technology companies, I mean, Microsoft's included in this. You remember Microsoft was sued at some point, and then they began a charm offensive and a lobbying campaign, and they spent millions trying to avoid this kind of thing happening again. And the problem is, I think right now, they don't want to change anything because of the profit model. But there also could come a point where people tire of this. They tire of the acrimony. I think at this juncture, if they're not going to be good citizens, it's very hard to get Congress to go along with it when it costs so much to run for election and they are contributing so much in ways direct and indirect to the candidacy of anyone that will not regulate them.
You know, there's definitely some problems in, number one, the power that the tech companies have. It's been really interesting to watch how quickly they shift their allegiances to the party in power. You know, will they switch again if a different party takes power? Probably, because what they really want, I think, is to avoid any sort of regulation. I think one of the other very significant problems in our electoral process these days is the presence of dark money. You know, since Citizens United was decided, it really opened the floodgates for PACs and super PACs, where we've got groups with lovely names like the Red, White, and Blue Grandmothers of America, who turns out to be, you know, Big Pharma or something like that. And it's difficult for people to know who's behind some of these ads. And I think it really opens us up to manipulation in terms of what we're seeing in terms of election ads and other kinds of things. I think it would take a constitutional amendment. Senator Jeanne Shaheen has actually proposed one, to amend the Constitution to permit campaign finance reform. You know, there have been a number of cases over the decades, Buckley versus Valeo and Citizens United, that says that people have a First Amendment right to make campaign expenditures, extending that to corporations and Citizens United. So there's just huge money that corporations are allowed to spend on elections and to really skew the outcome. And if we really care about one person, one vote, those of us who have less resources are not able to compete on the same level as some of these corporate giants who have millions of dollars to spend on elections. And so to really have a healthy democracy, we need to see a restoration of an even playing field. And that's going to require a constitutional amendment. It can happen. It's happened 27 times in our nation's history. And, you know, all it takes is for the public to reach a tipping point. You know, I am old enough to remember a time when drunk driving was sort of met with a shrug of the shoulders and a roll of the eyes. What are you going to do, right? People go to the bar after work, they're going to have a few drinks and things are going to happen. Well, it did until Mothers Against Drunk Driving got mad. And they stood up and they said, we're not going to take it anymore when our children are being killed by drunk drivers. And so there's a huge public service campaign, billboards and other things. And it is now considered, you know, immoral to drink and drive because of the risk that that presents to people. And so at some point, I think we do reach a tipping point where people say enough is enough and we demand legislation or a constitutional amendment to change the way we're doing things because it's just not working for the rest of us.
Well, I mean, I hope that that's right, but I do think that members of Congress are really depending on big money to help them get elected. If you are in Washington, and you know this, Barbara, on Thursday, they all disappear. You know, they can smell jet fuel. They're headed back, you know, to go and make some sort of money. You know, actually, on some level, I feel sorry for a lot of them. I mean, it's got to be the worst part of the job, running around and saying, I mean, I'm sure they all start out with, you know, stars in their eyes and I'm going to really make a difference. And then they're running again on a 2-year election cycle. And it's costing millions of dollars and they're heading with their hand out. And maybe they're from districts where they're never going to get those kinds of donations from the voters. And they're going to end up relying on some of these PACs and the money that comes from wherever it comes from. So I think you're right about that. But I don't know how we get them to that point when they're reliant on the very thing that they're going to have to kill.
Yeah, well, remember that they are beholden to their constituents. And so if enough voters care about it and say, this is an issue that is make or break for me, I'm not going to vote for you if you don't support this bill, then I think that ultimately can carry the day. So you're right. I mean, it is a self-fulfilling prophecy because people who want to buy a candidate can afford to do it. And if they keep doing that, they can buy enough ads to be influential in an election. But, you know, we've had some grassroots success here in Michigan. We had a program called Voters Not Politicians that was able to achieve a constitutional amendment to create a citizens commission to draw new district lines for congressional seats after every 10-year census. And that was a real take back of democracy in our state and showed to me that grassroots political efforts can be successful despite efforts by big money to push back because people want to gerrymander to rig the line so that they can control who's in Congress because they want to fill it with people who are friendly to their causes. You know, ultimately, we're a democracy and the people have the power.
One of the discussions that is being had by a lot of people right now is whether or not age gating of social media and banning cell phone use in schools is a possible solution. Now, I would just point out that as soon as this began being a topic, that Instagram introduced something called Instagram Teen or something, which sounded to me like a whole lot of nonsense, but also a way to sort of soft pedal and make it look like they were doing something to protect kids. Now, as a business, they have to rely on this next generation of spenders for targeted advertising. So they have every interest in fighting back on these cell phone bans in school. They have every interest in trying to oppose age gating. Jonathan Haidt's now written this book, and it seems pretty clear that if kids can avoid, and I think Richard Reeves has said a lot of this too, if you can keep them off of social media until they're a particular age, that their brains can better process what they're seeing. They become less addicted. And also you can use that time to teach them things that might make them better Americans and more engaged in our system.
Yeah, this is a terrific book. I've read this book, The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. And he really makes a persuasive case for the dangers of teens, kids with cell phones. Some of it is the disinformation they see online, and they are susceptible to it too. I mean, one of the things that's been going around high schools is deepfake porn, where somebody will take a photo that their friend posts online. It might be a teenage girl posing with her soccer teammates. And there are apps that are called nudify apps. They take a picture and they put it through the app, and it will take the head of their friend and put it on a nude body in a horrific pornographic image, and then send that image around on Instagram to all her friends, you know, which is humiliating and traumatizing for teens. So We are seeing disinformation there as well. But that's not the only problem. I mean, there are studies that show how it harms our ability to pay attention, that the interruption has really harmed our ability to engage, to listen, to be a good student, to sit in class. We need that constant dopamine hit of, gee, I wonder what, and if anybody has texted me, I wonder if anybody has sent me an email. We have to see that hit to get that rush every few minutes. And so as a result, it makes us much more difficult for us to concentrate. Some of the things that are causing trauma for girls are about feeling excluded. You know, one of the worst things you can do to a girl is feel left out from the community. And so feeling like everybody else is together having fun and you're not, fear of missing out, is something that causes a lot of anxiety among girls. For boys, there is a lot of exposure to pornography, to one-upsmanship, and other things to exclude them, and causing trauma for boys as well. So for young people, keeping cell phones away from them for as long as we can, I think is great. Now, maybe you aren't kept away from them 24 hours a day, but during the school day, collecting them at the schoolhouse door. I know my children got phones when they entered middle school, were biking to school by themselves, biking home from them for themselves, and as a safety device. Like, I wanted to know where they were when they were home and that they were okay. But do they need it during the school day in the classroom? I don't think so. So maybe you got to keep it in your locker all day. I think that's a pretty good rule.
I wanted to talk about civics education. Now, in the 1990s, civics education was removed from vast majority of U.S. school systems. And the reason for that had a lot to do with what we're talking about with the advent of the internet and the belief that we were now in a competition with other countries for technology, and the jobs would be in STEM, that you'd be computer engineers or statisticians or whatever. And so schools can only handle so much. And apparently they got rid of these civics classes in favor of STEM. I'm wondering if you think civics education would be something that, once introduced back into public school, could change the tide. And if we can't introduce it in public school, what are our other options?
Yeah, now this is such a great point, and I completely agree with you. I think civics education is critically important. And according to NPR, the federal government spends about $50 per student on STEM education and 5 cents per student on civics education. So I understand that STEM education is important, and maybe STEM education is more expensive because it requires certain equipment, but 5 cents per student? I mean, and of course it means lots of students are getting zero civics education whatsoever. But the reason civics education is so important is that if we don't understand the three branches of government and about how checks and balances are supposed to work, then when someone makes a claim that a judge who rules against a president's executive order is violating the Constitution or engaging in overreach and ought to be impeached, people understand how nonsensical that is. And so I think it is essential to a democracy for all of us to have basic civics education. And I think it's really falling by the wayside. Now, if our schools don't provide it, maybe there are other ways we can do it. I don't know about you, Lisa, but we're of similar vintage. I remember Schoolhouse Rock on Saturday mornings. I'd watch cartoons and I'd learn about how a bill becomes a law, right? I'm just a bill and I'm here on Capitol Hill. And that was a way to reach people where they were. Similarly, perhaps if you and I run the world and we do have this rule that social media platforms have to run public service announcements, maybe there could be TikTok videos or Instagram reels about how a bill becomes a law and how the judiciary serves as a check on executive and congressional overreach. So maybe we need to think more creatively about reaching people where they are, especially if we see the dismantling of the Department of Education and 5 cents turns to 0 cents for civics education.
Well, I will say this. This is not to contradict anything that you've said, but I will say that the expansion of Article II power, the idea of the unitary executive, is not one that is owned by this administration, that this has been sort of a slow drumbeat and an expansion. And part of that has to do with what we were talking about earlier, which is sort of congressional dysfunction and the focus on just trying to get reelected all the time. One of the guests on our podcast has been a Professor Harold Coe, who has written a book chronicling how Article 2 authority has been expanded in virtually every administration all along, going back to Reynolds. But even before that, how the presidents, one after another, have used executive orders when Congress would not act. And that it's gotten to the point where people could be confused about the role of the courts if they were not educated on civics. I guess that's my opinion. And I mean, you're free to disagree with me, but I think that this has been a long time coming and that the other structural problems that you mentioned, in particular, you talk about gerrymandering, creating more extreme versions, much like the algorithm does in Facebook. Yes. We're getting extreme versions of people in Congress.
Yes.
And I can tell you, yes, when I was a kid, you know, we moved overseas for many years. But before we left, you know, we lived inside the Beltway. Senators, congressmen were our neighbors of all parties. And we had a community swimming pool. And they didn't get on planes and fly back to Arizona, Illinois every single weekend. But they did go to the community pool and they would socialize with each other and their kids played together. And they had conversations. And they often discussed the business of Congress in a very nice way that you just don't see right now. They just go home. There's no interaction. It really doesn't appear to me to be any of that.
Yeah. And so, you know, that gets back to this idea that when you interact with people, you can find commonalities across difference if they are not spending time together. I also think there is this performative aspect of congressional hearings now, where people are like, they don't even care about the answer. They ask questions at these hearings because they want to get a little clip for either the 6 o'clock news at back home or for social media where they can say, oh, look at Representative so-and-so chewing out this government official. Oh, they really care about us. And it's all just a performance. I think that is really harmful as well, creating this perception and reality that there's Team Red and Team Blue, and it's all just, you know, blood sport. And that's all that matters is that our team wins. And that's just destructive to democracy. But, you know, we can come up with solutions. Maybe one of the solutions is term limits. That has some problems, some downsides as well, because you don't develop the expertise that maybe you want in Congress, but maybe it prevents people from constantly chasing the dollars for their reelection. It seems that so many of these members of Congress have abandoned truth and responsibility because all they care about is getting reelected and they don't want a primary challenge. So they're willing to do anything or say anything for self-preservation. And that is so destructive to democracy. You know, where is the moral courage? And if we don't have it innately, then maybe we need to create it by installing term limits so that they can't simply constantly pander for dollars.
Well, they'd have to vote on that, I think. That would be the problem. I also wanted to talk to you a little bit about how these divisions and partisan arguments cause a loss of respect for the rule of law in general. Yeah. A win at any cost idea. And I think there's also, when you talk about performative, and I think this is a nice segue here, there used to be a jury instruction that they would give that talked about not expressing an opinion immediately, but listening to the facts of the case. And they did this in California, where they talked about a sense of pride that would be aroused in any individual who immediately stated a conclusion about a case. And that instruction was given to force people to deliberate on the facts of any case and communicate with one another and make sure they all had an understanding of the evidence and what conclusions should be reached. And I've always loved that instruction only because I think it is important for people not to immediately express an opinion. Yeah. Because it does arouse a sense of pride. And I think this is amplified by 1,000 times on the internet, because once you put something out there and it lives in perpetuity.
Yeah.
And then, you know, if 5 minutes later, it turns out whatever you've said isn't based on the truth, now you're humiliated. What do you say next? So I just wonder what your thoughts are, because I know one of the big concerns is we want to hold on to our rule of law.
I have great concerns about what's happening to the rule of law. And I think it is fostered by disinformation. When we had false claims about the pandemic, there were public health officials who were finding themselves the subject of death threats and harassment. When schools were closed down, we had school boards and school officials who got the same kinds of threats. Judges are being subjected to threats like never before. Members of Congress, members of state houses. In Michigan, our Secretary of State had armed protesters outside her home when she was home alone with her young son. Our governor was the subject of a kidnapping plot by people who didn't like her stay-home orders during the COVID pandemic. And I think part of it is with all of this disinformation fueling outrage, that the reason that this is happening is because they are corrupt, or they are stealing power, or they've stolen an election, whatever it is, people become so outraged and they feel like they're helpless, that our institutions are letting them down because we hear all of these awful things about our institutions, that they feel compelled to take the law into their own hands. And so that's what brings us things like all of these threats, or sometimes it crosses over into real violence. The man who brought a hammer into Nancy Pelosi's home and attacked her husband, he's likely seen decades of these ads of fire Nancy Pelosi, with her depicted as a devil with flames around her, right? Demonizing her through political advertising. Or the people who attacked the Capitol on January 6th because they were told an election had been stolen and were outraged by that and thought they needed to take back their country. They went and used brute force to try to get a result that they could not get through the ballot box or through courts of law, all of which had rejected these challenges to the claim of a stolen election. Because of the disinformation they had been fed, they felt the need to take the law into their own hands to save our country through vigilante violence. And so I think that the disinformation is fueling this erosion of the rule of law that I think can be a very dangerous thing. You know, in our country, we can disagree about things vigorously, passionately, but at the end of the day, we have to respect court decisions when we have differences of opinion and we take them to court. Some of the things we're hearing now is that courts' decisions should not be respected, and who's going to enforce them? That's a very dangerous place to be. I don't know about you, but I am a smallish, middle-aged, weak woman, and I don't like my chances in a world of the survival only of the fittest, by who's got the most brute force to get their way. And so I count on the rule of law to protect me. And I think most of us do the same.
I think that's right. And I'm really glad that I got a chance to talk to you. I see you all the time on television when I'm occasionally looking at it, as I hardly do these days. I'm so busy, and I'm sure you are too. But I'm really glad you wrote the book. And as soon as I heard that you had it out, I want you to know I went and got it.
Oh, thank you.
Like almost immediately. And I was very pleased to see that you had written it. And I wish you continued success. I imagine, are you going to do another one?
I don't know. You know, I didn't write this book because I wanted to write a book. I wrote this book because I've been thinking about this issue for a long time. And I wanted to help lay people, non-lawyers, to understand the problem and potential solutions. So I don't know. If I have something else to say, then maybe I will say it in a book. But if not, I hope you'll read this one.
We'll certainly link it in the notes to
thank
the
you.
Cast. Well, it's good to see you. And thank you so much for coming in tonight. Our guest tonight has been Barbara McQuaid. I call her Barb because that's what I've always called her. But she's the former U.S. attorney for the Eastern District of Michigan. She's also one of the hosts of the Sister-in-Law podcast, which you can find on Apple Podcasts and other listening platforms, and a legal analyst for NBC News and MSNBC News. We'll hyperlink to the book and to her podcast in the notes to our cast. And thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to give us a rating on your listening app of choice, and like and share this podcast. Guess what that does? It triggers the algorithm. It gets our podcast amplified. We're committed to bringing you cost-free, intelligent content. It's not always going to be stuff you agree with. And that's the point, right? It will enrich you and make you a smart person at the party or in any conversation with your friends or colleagues. Don't even try it against your family. Give up on that one. Be sure to share this episode with a friend as well. Remember to hear other people's opinions in arguments. It'll improve your skills as a lawyer, make you a better citizen, and it will contribute to our national security, which is dependent upon our unity, really, in a country that's more diverse, not just in the way we look, but we're more diverse in thought than any other country. Doubt me, travel. You will see very quickly that we tolerate a lot of discourse in this country that is verboten elsewhere, or maybe even illegal. So enjoy the ability to share ideas and opinions with one another. Our writer, producer, and host is me, Elisa Poteet, but I'm always here in my individual capacity. Our editor and my co-producer is the ever lovely Frances Burkham, now of Ohio. My other co-producer is the amazing, constantly amazing, never changing strength. She is better than all the suffragists and Lady Liberty, Holly McMahon, along with all the august, brilliant, wonderful members of the Bipartisan Standing Committee on Law and National Security. And without them, this podcast would not be possible. We'll see you next time.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.